I've entitled this talk, Imagining a Moga City. And I was amazed early this evening. I was on my way to the Buddhist Centre, and I got off the bus at Gulmarsh Plan and decided I'd walk across the bridge to Skanstul and to the Buddhist Centre. And all the way along, there were people wearing green. And I passed these pubs, and there were all these people wearing green. And I thought, this is absolutely amazing. And I had no idea the Sri Ratna Buddhist movement had so much influence in Stockholm, you know, that everybody was wearing green in honour of this talk on Imoga City tonight. But I thought, hang on, they do look a bit like football fans. And I thought, it reminded me that one of the associations with green that is very strong for me is the green and white of Glasgow Celtic. So later on, you'll have to tell me which Stockholm football team this is. Okay. I have very big memories of Henrik Larsson wearing green. Yeah, so there's a very strong Swedish connection there. So that's by the way. I thought that was a very good coincidence. So, what's behind my talk tonight? Well, it's this. We're surrounded here by traditional images of Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, the Wheel of Life. But not everyone finds it easy to emotionally connect with the traditional Eastern images or accounts of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Many of the representations that we have come from the East. Many of the accounts of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas come from the East. And these traditional Eastern images and accounts come from very different cultures and conditions and histories with their own background myths and stories. So what I've been reflecting on for a long time, actually, particularly in relation to Imoga City, is how I or we might use our imagination to explore our particular individual and our particular collective memories, myths and cultures, to find maybe a different way to connect with the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Something that connects with our memory, our culture, our histories. And maybe when we engage with our imagination in this way, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas might appear in very different forms. Some point in the future that might start to happen. May even be completely different. At present, unknown Buddhas and Bodhisattvas arise out of the interaction between Buddhism and Western cultures and myths and histories. So what I'm going to do in this talk is to give you an account of my personal explorations inspired by the Green Buddha of the North, Imoga City. And these are personal explorations. They reflect the fact, first of all, that I'm English, that I've lived a large part of my life in England, some in Scotland, but most in England, but I've lived especially in the north of England. So my explorations are informed by the cultural and historical and geographical background to my upbringing. And they're informed by the special conditions of my own life. So my aim in giving this talk is not to persuade you that your view of Imoga City or how you connect with Imoga City should be the same as mine. That's not at all what I'm trying to do. My hope is that if I explain to you some of my explorations of Imoga City, that will inspire you to reflect upon your own individual and collective memories and cultures, geography, nature, and to use your imagination to connect with, not just with Imoga City, but with whatever Buddha or Bodhisattva your heart inclines towards. So my hope is that you will be in some way inspired to explore Buddhas and Bodhisattvas from your own particular life perspective. So just to remind you of a few of the most important characteristics of a Moga Siddhi. He's the Buddha of the northern realm. He's the green Buddha of the northern realm. We have a green representation here, and we have a photograph of a rupa of a Moga Siddhi there. But he's the green Buddha of the northern realm. His mudra is the mudra of fearlessness. His wisdom is all-accomplishing. His element is air or wind. And his emblem or symbol is the double vajra, the visva vajra, the crossed vajra, sometimes the sword. And he counters the poison of envy, the poison of jealousy. So that's some of the particular characteristics of a Moga Siddhi. Some of the things that you will pick up from the standard accounts of a Moga Siddhi and from the iconography of a Moga Siddhi. And I want to explore some of these characteristics and how they connect with me personally. And I'm going to start with a Moga Siddhi as the Buddha of the northern realm. So the north, for me, evokes an image of the mountain wilderness of the Scottish islands and highlands. It evokes a wild, cold wind blowing around ancient dolmen and circles of standing stones. It evokes northern Scandinavia and the land of the midnight sun, where at the height of summer, the sun never sets, and the depths of winter, the sun never rises. It evokes the North Pole, with its howling gales and vast expanses of snow and frozen seas. It evokes tundra. It evokes forests of green pine standing amongst frozen expanses of white snow. The north, for me, is a sense of standing alone amongst some of the harshest forces in nature. The north is purifying, blasting away internal and external pollutants of urban life. It's primeval. It's both scary and enormously attractive at the same time. And it's mysterious. So the north evokes very different things in me. And the north, of course, has always been a guide. It's been a guide to the exploration of our planet. For centuries, the North Star guided mariners and ships across the seas. It may even have guided the Vikings to America long before Christopher Columbus. And more recently, the North has been a guide, has been a guide through the magnetic compass, walking in the mountains of Scotland, walking in the snowy expanses of the Alps, or ski touring in the Alps, using compasses to be guided through the mountains. So, the north is a guide. There's also, of course, the northern lights, the aurora borealis. I've seen pale imitations of the northern lights from Scotland. I've never seen them at their best. Not yet. But if I stay long enough in the northern realm, I hope that I'll be able to see them in their full glory. And I'm told, and I've seen pictures of this, that when you see them in their full glory, they can pulse with this beautiful green light, the colour of a Moga Siddhi. So you have images of this flowing green light across the sky. So there's something magical and mysterious about the northern lights. There's even been a trilogy of books for children, which many adults like myself have read in the last 10 or 50 years, by a man called Philip Pullman. The first book of which is called The Northern Lights, where the children journey to the North Pole and the Northern Lights. And that's the start of the trilogy. And the journey to the North Pole and the Northern Lights opens up to the travellers the possibilities of travel to other dimensions and universes. So this is something that lives in me from quite recent mythology. So the North is many, many things and quite inspiring. And when I talk about the Northern Lights, I've already mentioned, they're green for me. That's how I imagine them to be. And it's the colour green that I want now to explore. It's the colour of leaves, of grass, of growing crops of wheat. It's the colour of vigorous growth and of fertility. And this idea of green, this connection with green, is embodied in the ancient pagan image of the green man. Do you have the green man in Sweden? Does that image appear here? It's a very important and well-known image in countries like England and other parts of Europe. You find medieval representations of the green man in churches and cathedrals all over England. If you visit Norwich Cathedral near Padmaloka Retreat Centre and go into the cloister walk at the side of the cathedral and walk around, you will find images of the green man. Sometimes he has horns growing out of his head. Plants come out of his mouth and ears. So he's a very unusual and rich symbol. Interestingly, the reason why the green man is there, as far as I understand it, is that the stonemasons who built the cathedrals and churches still held to some of their pagan beliefs. And there was a kind of contract that they made in building the cathedrals and churches. And that contract included a clause whereby they could put up images of the green man. So there was this trade-off between the Christian church and the stonemason. So even in medieval times, pagan beliefs and symbols were still very much alive in England. And connected to the green man is the Celtic god Chernunnos. He's the horned god, or the lord of the forest. You often see images of him with the antlers of stags or horns coming out of his head. And the most famous depiction of Chernunnos is an image that is contained in the so-called Gundestrup cauldron, a large silver bowl that was discovered in a peat bog in Denmark. And the bowl has been dated to around the 1st century BCE. And there's an image of Chernunnos inside this bowl. And archaeologists refer to this image as Chernunnos in Buddha position, because he appears to be sitting in the cross-legged meditation posture. And you find images of a so-called stag man, a man with horns of a stag, going right back to prehistoric Paleolithic cave paintings in France. So that the origins of Chernunnos and of the green man are very old indeed. And in many of the different cultures where you find Chernunnos and other images of the stag man, they're presented as the god who sits between worlds, the god who guards the threshold that divides the spiritual world and this world. So there's a mythology there, certainly in England and other parts of Europe, that has crept up at least as far as Denmark. But for me, it's very interesting that when I came across Amoga City, the Green Buddha of the North, the story that came into my mind was a memory of a story that I heard at school. And this was the story of Gawain and the Green Knight. Do you know who Gawain was? Gawain was one of the main knights in King Arthur's Knights of the Round Table. And this is a Middle English dialect, medieval story about Sir Gawain and this green knight. It's a story of mystery and magic and fearlessness, all qualities of a Moga city. Now, I'm just going to tell you very briefly the story. And you'll hear bits of it and you'll think, well, that's nonsense. I can't believe that. Just let it flow by you. Sometimes I tell the story, people say, oh, but Barry, what, you know. No, just hear it. Just hear it. Just suspend any judgment about it. Just hear this wonderful, bizarre story. So you imagine all the knights of the Round Table, one New Year's Day, sat around with King Arthur. And into Camelot walks this huge figure, a green knight. His skin is green. He's dressed all in green. He's like a giant. And he issues a challenge. And he says, I will offer my head to any knight to cut off, provided that that knight will accept a blow from me in 1 year's time on New Year's Day. So he issues this challenge. And none of the knights want to take it up. And Gawain thinks, well, somebody's got to, for the honour of the Round Table. So Gawain steps forward. And the Green Knight has brought this axe with him, with a razor sharp blade. He gives it to Gawain, bends down. Gawain chops off the head of the Green Knight. Green Knight stands up, picks up his head, turns the head to Gawain, and says, okay, I will see you at the Green Chapel, New Year's Day, 1 year from now, when you will accept the return blow, and walks off and disappears. So the following winter, around Christmas time, Gawain is heading north. He's actually heading north to a part of the country that I know very well in England, the Peak District, because the Green Chapel is like a cleft between rocks in a part of the Peak District, which is mountains and dales. Beautiful limestone area. Gawain is getting close to it, and on Christmas Eve, he comes across a castle in a wood. And the lord of the castle is a man called Bertulac. So there's Lord Bertulac. He has a beautiful wife, Lady Bertulac. And there is this very odd and mysterious old, ugly woman who seems to be a sort of servant and companion to Lady Bertulac. And they say to Gawain, look, the Green Chapel is very near. Stay here for this week, and then you can go to the Green Chapel on New Year's Day. So he stays there for a week. And each day, Bertulac goes out hunting. And he makes an agreement with Gawain, Sir Gawain, that when he comes back from hunting, he will give Gawain whatever he has found and caught on his hunt. And Gawain, who stays inside the castle all day, in return agrees to give to Bertulac whatever he is given in the castle. So Bertulac goes off. Bertulac's away during the day, and Lady Bertulac, this extraordinarily beautiful woman, tries to seduce Gawain. She passionately kisses him, trying to seduce him. Gawain resists. Each night Bertulac comes back, he hands over the trophy from the hunt, and Gawain passionately kisses Bertulac. And it goes on like this. Towards the end of the week, however, Lady Bertulac gives Gawain a green girdle or garter. And she says to Gawain, this green girdle will protect you, will help to protect you when you go to meet the Green Knight. And Sir Gawain, fearing for his life and glad to get any help he can, secretly keeps this. He does not give it over to Bertulac, to Lord Bertulac. Anyway, New Year's Day comes. Gawain goes off, finds the Green Chapel, and in strides the Green Knight. Gawain kneels down and bows his head, ready to receive the blow from the axe, for his head to be chopped off. And when the Green Knight raises his axe, Gawain flinches. And the Green Knight rebukes him, tells him to keep still. And so he keeps still. Down comes the axe and stops, just cutting, slight cut, in Sir Gawain's neck. And at that moment, the Green Knight is transformed into Lord Berchelac. And Lord Berchelac says, "Thank goodness, the spell is broken. The old ugly woman who was living with them was Morgan le Fay, the deadly enemy of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, who had cast a spell on them and had devised this game in order to dishonour the Knights of the Round Table. First of all, hoping that nobody would be brave enough to accept the challenge of the Green Knight. And secondly, that whoever came would be seduced by Lady Berchelac. And because Sir Gawain resisted and was honourable and brave and accepted the challenge and came to have his head cut off, the spell was broken." And Berchelac said, "However, there's a cut, a little cut in your neck, and that's because you did not hand me the green garter." So Sir Gawain, instead of feeling pleased at what he's done, feels ashamed. And he returns to the round table and tells his story, wearing the green garter on his arm as a badge of shame. He feels shame. And of course everybody else thinks he's been incredibly brave. So the next morning, all of the knights of the round table and King Arthur go to ride out. And Gawain comes out a bit sheepishly, wearing the green garter on his arm, to discover that every single knight also is wearing a green garter on their arm in honour of Sir Gawain. You don't have to analyse, figure out that story. Just let it sit there. This is something that, you know, Arthurian legend is something that's quite important for me. Quite important. And that story came to mind in connection with Amoghasiddhi, the green Buddha of the north. The green colour also marks him out from Ratnasambhava, Amitabha and Akshobhya, the blue, yellow and red Buddhas, because they are primary colours. Amoghasiddhi's green is a secondary colour. It's a mixture of the blue of Akshobhya and the yellow of Ratnasambhava. And Lama Govinda, do you know Lama Govinda? Any of you heard of Lama Govinda? The German Buddhist teacher who was a friend of Sangharakshita's in India, an artist, a very interesting artist, who had his own Buddhist movement in Germany. And he's written quite a few very interesting books on Buddhism. He makes great play of the fact that Amoghasiddhi is the green Buddha and the green is a mixture of the colours of blue and yellow. He says Amoghasiddhi represents the sun at midnight. And he talks of the yellow light of an inner sun, which is invisible to human eyes and which weaves in with the deep blue of the night sky to form what he describes as the serene, mystic green of Amoghasiddhi. And for him, the sun at midnight represents the mysterious activity of spiritual forces which are at work, removed from the senses. They're invisible, they're imperceptible to us, but they guide the individual towards the maturity of knowledge and liberation. There's an echo here of the mysterious way in which the sun and air interact to produce the green of plants and trees. So green is a serene and mystic colour. But there's another side to green, and this is reflected in the very common English phrase, "I was green with envy." So do you have the same phrase? It's interesting, almost every country that I know of, the same phrase, "I was green with envy." Because this is very interesting in terms of the iconography and the accounts of Amoghasiddhi, because he is the Buddha who presides over the realm of the Titans. If you look later on the image of the Wheel of Life there, when you look at the realm of the Titans or the jealous gods, you'll find that there's a green Buddha there in Moga City with a sword, holding the sword of wisdom. So he presides over the realm of the jealous or envious gods. So these jealous gods or Titans are powerful, jealous beings, and they fight the gods. And when they're defeated, they turn their envy and jealousy on each other. They're very energetic, very powerful. They despise weakness. The only things they respect are power, energy, and success. It's no good giving them sermons on gentleness and humility. They'll assume that you're someone weak trying to trick them into giving up their superiority. Most probably they would not even stop to take in your arguments to listen to you at all. To convert the Titans, to convert the jealous gods to the Dharma, they would need to see that you have something that they do not. Only if you can match their energy and resourcefulness will you even get them to listen. So for dealing with the jealous gods, with the Titans, Amoga City sometimes is depicted as brandishing this flaming sword, the sword of knowledge of wisdom. He has the power of this sword. He also sometimes is seen with the crossed Vajras, the Visva Vajra, the double Vajras, two diamond thunderbolts joined together, enormous power. So whichever emblem or symbol he carries with him, this gives him a lot of power and forces the Titans to listen. He has a lot of energy at his command. Omoga's city has this idea of unobstructed success. He's infallible. He does not have a weakness to be exploited. And so the Titans are prepared to listen to Amoga City because of his strength and energy. And through listening to Amoga City, they can gain enlightenment. It might seem strange that they can make this abrupt transition from being jealous or envious gods to being wise beings. They can shift from envy and hatred to wisdom. Because they have envy and hatred, though, they have a lot of energy. And the idea behind this is the characteristic of hatred and envy is to want to destroy the object of hatred and envy. There's a lot of energy behind this. And the characteristic of wisdom or insight is to destroy everything that is unreal, to destroy our illusions about the world and universe we see around us, and thus to see things as we really are. Sangharakshita says that wisdom has the function of reducing to dust everything which is not reality. So Titans have a great deal of energy. The jealous gods have a great deal of energy locked up in their envy and hatred. If it can be diverted and released, that energy, it can be diverted and released into the discovery and realization of wisdom and truth. And Amoga City helps to achieve that task by his energy, his wisdom, his compassion, and most of all by his fearlessness. Because this is the other characteristic of Amoga City, his fearlessness, the mudra of fearlessness. And if we look in Buddhism, there's actually many stories that we can find, examples of fearlessness in the face of great danger. There's the story told about Hakuin, the great 18th century Japanese Zen master. He's sitting meditating when he's approached by a powerful samurai warrior who demands of Hakuin, "Where is heaven and where is hell?" Hakuin sits without moving, just opens his eyes a little bit, looks up at the samurai very briefly, just takes a look at him, closes his eye, stays seated in meditation, and then he speaks. He mocks the samurai. "What's the matter? Are you frightened of hell? You're a sniveling coward. You're not worth teaching at all. And the samurai pulls his sword out to strike Hakuin. And as he's holding his sword about to strike Hakuin, Hakuin quietly says, "Now you're in hell." The samurai has a realization. He sinks to his knees and begs for forgiveness. And Hakuin says, "And now you're in heaven." I don't think I could do that. That's a pretty amazing teaching, isn't it? Fearlessness. Fearlessness as well as great wisdom. And of course, there's a story of the Buddha and Angulimala, which I know that some of you will be very familiar with. You know, Angulimala, Angulimala means necklace or garland of fingers. This is the man who has taken a vow to kill, I think it's 100 people. And when he kills them, he cuts off a finger and he adds it to a necklace that he wears around his neck. Every time, you know, you see Buddhists rotating their malas, just remember the story of Angulimala. So this is a mala of fingers. And he's at 99. He wants one more. And I think one of the stories says he's so desperate, he can't find anybody, that he's even thinking of killing his mother for the 100th, to get the 100th. But the Buddha's in the area and he hears the story of Angulimala, and maybe telepathically he realizes that he might kill his mother. And he says to the others, "I'm going to go and see him." And they beg him, "No, you don't go in there. He'll kill you. He'll kill you." "I'm going in." The Buddha sets off fearlessly, just walking mindfully along the road. Angulimala sees this monk walking mindfully along the road, jumps up and down for glee. "I've got it, I've got it. Here's my 100th victim." Runs down on the road to catch the monk up and kill him, running like crazy, and he can't catch him up. He runs harder and harder and harder. He can't catch the monk up. Eventually, he's exhausted, and he shouts out to the Buddha, "Stop, monk, stop." And the Buddha turns round and calmly replies, "I have stopped, Angulimala. I have stopped." And the Buddha explains to Angulimala that his mind, the Buddha's mind, had stopped dealing with greed, hatred, and delusion, and had arrived at a place which Angulimala could not reach with his sword. And Angulimala was so impressed with the Buddha and with this statement that he becomes a disciple of the Buddha and eventually gains enlightenment. He still has to take some of the karmic retribution of his murders. The villagers throw stones at him and so on, but he's transformed by the Buddha's fearlessness and wisdom. It highlights the qualities of an enlightened being that's encapsulated particularly in the figure of a Mogacity. The Buddha is active, takes direct action, fearlessly, to find Angulimala and tackle Angulimala. And there's also the mystery and paradox of what is happening. How can a Buddha, slowly and mindfully walking along the road, outpace Angulimala, who's running very fast, to catch him up? So ultimately, I think this is telling us that true fearlessness can only be attained by having insight into reality. And when we see the way things really are, we realize the illusoriness of the ego, which we seek to protect and which we fear for. And with the complete letting go of egotistical concerns and complete letting go of the fear of dying, which is the primary fear, if you like, then all fears disappear. We realize, if you like, that there is no one to die. So, fearlessness. And I mentioned the ego there. And this brings me, in a roundabout way, to, they're not on that picture, but they're here, the Shangshang creatures. Shangshang creatures. When a Mogacity arrives, he flies through the air on a chariot, and he's being pulled through the air by these creatures called Shangshang creatures, half man, half bird. And they have symbols which they clash together. So they go through the fly through the sky, half man, half bird, clashing these symbols. So what do these symbols, when they're clashed together, what do they represent? Well, one way I've read that they described is that they forcefully unite all the corners or poles of existence. They forcefully unite all the corners or poles of existence. Now, a phrase like that either appeals to you as being very mysterious or it just flies by you. That one flies by me. The one that caught my attention was, and this is much more crude, they are ego bashers. So this is the idea that every time your ego raises its head, the symbols are crashed together, shaking the ego to its foundations. So just imagine, okay, every time in the day your ego asserts itself, a Moga City or the Shangshan creatures are nearby and they go boom, right on your head, clashing their symbols together. The mighty symbols of the Shangshan creatures crash around you, ego bashers. So it's symbols, of course. You know, if you go and watch a band or you listen to an orchestra, I really like hearing symbols, sound, because a Moga City's element is air or wind, and sound moves through air. Orchestras make sound through the air. Symbols do. Wind instruments do. They make a very vivid and particular sound. So this got me to wondering about what kind of sound might be associated with a Moga City. And in particular, what kind of sound would be made with the entrance of a Moga City into the realm of the jealous gods. Imagine, a Moga City is arriving into the realm of the Titans, into the realm of the jealous gods. And they've got to have their attention caught by a Moga City. How would he do it? Well, there's a clue. We've had the sound of cymbals, the sound of air, of wind instruments, but there's also another slightly unexpected twist to this story. I didn't fully realize this until I started investigating Moga City. But, you know, these Buddhas, the five Buddhas, we have them in a particular form and names, but they develop over time. And there was an earlier Buddha of the North. And the earlier Buddha of the North was Dundubhishvara, the Lord of the Drum. He appears in the Sutra of Golden Light. He's also the Buddha before whom Tara, as a princess, took the vow, the Bodhisattva vow. Very interesting this, that there's a connection between Dundubhishvara and Tara, the consort of a Moga City. The forerunner of a Moga City is the Lord of the Drum. So we have drum, cymbals, wind instruments. Three big elements there. So what would the sound of a Moga City entering the realm of the Titans go like? So I'll just ask my road manager here. Desmond wanted to be my road manager for this, but and hopefully this will work. We'll soon see. Just give it a minute. Computer needs to warm up a little bit. Thank you. quite an entrance. So some of you may already know the answer to this. Any guesses where that's from? Tibetan? Yes. Pretty sure it's Tibetan?
Is it
Scottish?
No.
Scottish? Tibetan? Well, I don't think you would ever get it. You don't think you would ever get it. That is from medieval northern Spain, and it's a procession in honour of the Virgin Mary. It's in honour of the Virgin Mary. It's played by a group called the Dufay Collective, who specialise in medieval music. It's incredible, isn't it? It sounds, you think it's Tibetan, but it's actually music in honour of the Virgin Mary. So they obviously had something that modern Christianity doesn't have. I mean, that's like, you know, quite extraordinary processional music. So that's Amoghasiddhi's entry into the realm of the Titans. So we're getting close to the end of the talk now. There's one more piece of music to come. But there's one thing I wanted to return to, and that's the symbolism of the crossed Vajras, of the double Vajra, the Visva Vajra. Because this is something quite mysterious. When you read Vasantara's account, you know, in meeting the Buddhas of Amoghasiddhi and the symbolism of the Visva Vajra, he says it's the symbol of the total psychic integration of the unfoldment of all potential of perfect harmony, balance, and equilibrium within the individual consciousness. Quite a big thing to take in there. He also says that the double Vajra, the crossed Vajra, in Indian cosmology and in Indian Buddhist cosmology, is the support on which the whole universe rests. So the double Vajra, the cross Vajra, the Visva Vajra, is the support on which the whole universe rests, and it's got something to do with the total psychic integration or unfoldment of potential of our consciousness. And he goes on to say, this means that the fundamental pattern or support or matrix of both of the universe and of the integrated individual consciousness is the same. It's the same. And this had an echo for me. And you might be familiar with this story from the Pali Canon, the Rohitissa Sutta, where Rohitissa has been asking the Buddha, how do I get to the place where the cosmos ends? And the Buddha says to him, I tell you, friend, that it is not possible by travelling to know or see or reach a far end of the cosmos where one does not take birth, age, die, pass away, or reappear. But at the same time, I tell you that there is no making an end of suffering and stress without reaching the end of the cosmos. Yet it is just within this fathom-long body, with its perception and intellect, that I declare that there is the cosmos, the origination of the cosmos, the cessation of the cosmos, and the path of the practice leading to the cessation of the cosmos. What does this mean? I think Vasantara sums all this up very well. One way of interpreting all of this is to understand yourself in your deepest nature is to understand the nature of the universe. To understand yourself in your deepest nature is to understand the nature of the universe. Now, the thing is, when I hear that, sometimes you hear or read a phrase, and even if you're not quite sure exactly what it means, the full implications of it, it captures your attention, and you know that it's something that's really, really important, and it has a powerful effect. And that phrase, to understand yourself in your deepest nature, is to understand the nature of the universe, in some ways has more effect upon me than a picture of a Moga city. But it comes out of a consideration of what makes up a Moga city. But maybe when you consider Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and you read about them and you think about them and you look at their iconography, a phrase will come up. And that phrase can cut through to something deep within you and has more meaning for you, maybe, than the image at that point in time. So my sadhana is White Tara, and I have a really beautiful image of White Tara. But the thing that captures my attention most about White Tara was reading that White Tara sits at the still centre of the universe. White Tara sits at the still centre of the universe. And that, in some wordless way, evokes a sense of White Tara in me, perhaps that is more meaningful than an image. It doesn't come in the form of an image, but nevertheless, something deep within me is stirred by that statement. So that's why I've explored the symbolism of the cross vajra, of the double vajra, the Vishva vajra. So, right at the end now. How are we doing for time? Can I add just a few more minutes to finish? I'd like to sort of just return to Lama Govinda, because Lama Govinda is very interesting in his contemplations of Amoga City. He talks about the wisdom of Amoga City, which is all accomplishing. And I'm going to read you a bit that he says about Amoga City. And he quotes Rabindranath Tagore, the Indian writer and poet. So this is what Govinda says. All accomplishing wisdom consists in the synthesis of heart and mind, in the union of all-embracing love and deepest knowledge, in the complete self-surrender to the highest ideal of human striving, which finds the force for its realization in the fearless acceptance of life's sufferings. He who is inspired by this attitude takes upon himself the bodhisattva vow at the feet of the Buddha in the eternal presence of all of the enlightened ones, and may remember the words of Tagore. This is Tagore. Let me not pray to be sheltered from dangers, but to be fearless in facing them. Let me not beg for the stilling of my pain, but for the heart to conquer it. Let me not look for allies in life's battlefield, but to my own strength. Let me not crave in anxious fear to be saved, but hope for patience to win my freedom. So I really like that. Lama Govinda is well worth reading on the five Buddhas, particularly on Amoga City. Brings out something in a different way, think, from other writers. So I've covered quite a lot of ground here. But as I said at the start, my idea is not to convince you or persuade you that you should see Amoga City in the way that I have made connections with him, but to encourage you to explore the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas through your own imagination. So you might think about, what does the North mean for you? What does it evoke in you? What do the East or the West or the South, or up into the sky, the zenith, or down into the earth, the nadir, what do they mean to you? Does something come up for you when you consider directions like that? What does the colour green evoke in you? What do other colours evoke? What's your favourite colour? What does it evoke in you? What myths or stories live most strongly in you? What myths or stories live most strongly in your culture? What aspects of nature of geography, of animals, of birds, of plants, etc., appeal most to you? What's around you that appeals most to you? What words or phrases evoke in you a sense of wordless wonder? What music, what literature, what poetry, what art moves you? Because these are all potential gateways to making contact with the Buddha. They're all potential gateways to making contact with the Buddha. And we need to fully engage with our imagination, with our culture, with our memories, with our geography and nature, to try to discover the Buddha or Bodhisattva that lies within us. So I just want to finish with a second piece of music. Now, this piece of music is very personal to me. When I was growing up, 9 or 10 or 11, 12, that sort of age, I have this very, very strong memory of sitting in front of the television with my mother and father once a week to watch a program, which Desmond will probably remember as well, called This Week, a current affairs program on British television. And there was a piece of music that played at the start of the program. And I knew nothing about classical music then. I know very little now, even, I think, about classical music. But I knew that this was the days when I had hair. It used to make my hair stand on end. And it still does. You know, what little hair I have stands on end when I hear this music. It really knocks me out. And then there's this wonderful synchronicity, this wonderful coincidence, that later in life I discover this piece of music, of course, has very strong connections with the North. And those of you who know classical music will spot the connection straight away. Those of you who don't, and don't know this piece, I'll tell you afterwards. So this is the final piece of music. So just close your eyes and listen to this and imagine this is a Moga city flying down from the North, being towed by the Shangshan birds, coming down maybe over the mountains, the tundra of northern Sweden, Norway, Finland, down over the mountains, heading down over the summer green landscape of Sweden. Except you might think it's associated more with another country, but we'll see. So apologies for using a piece of Finnish music. That was the intermezzo from Sibelius's Karelia Suite. But it's still Nordic. That's all.